Boxwoods are a mainstay of the Midwest landscape. According to a 2020 study from the Horticulture Research Institute, boxwoods were the number one evergreen shrub sold in the United States. The study also revealed that the production of boxwoods in 2020 generated 11 million individual plants sold to buyers and an overall revenue of $126 million. From my experience, you would be hard-pressed to find a city block in any Midwestern suburban neighborhood that didn't contain at least a few boxwoods. To top it off, boxwoods are the in plant when it comes to new landscape installations. Most clients are requesting landscape designs that include boxwoods in the plan. Today, I am joined by Bill Dooley, a plant healthcare expert at Ryan Lawn and Tree. We will be discussing why these plants are so popular in the landscape, what it takes to maintain healthy plants, and the disease and insect issues that can cause problems with these foundational evergreens in the modern landscape. So to get started, I would like to have Bill introduce himself. And this is kind of a special podcast because, as most of you know, I am super excited about horticulture. And I started my career in horticulture at 14, working for a local lawn company. But at the age of 16, I started working for a local nursery in the metro here, Family Tree Nursery. And Bill Dooley, who I'm joined by today, who will soon introduce himself, was my first ever manager. And if I think back when I was 16, that makes it almost 36 years that we've known each other, Bill.
That's a long time, Matt. Thanks for making me feel old.
I was 16 at that time. So, Bill, a few questions for you to have you introduce yourself.
Sure.
What's your role at Ryan Lawn and Tree?
I am a plant health care specialist 2.
Okay.
Which means I am in the field diagnosing diseases, applying pesticides to control certain insect or disease issues for my clients. My routes here in the Kansas City area, mostly on the Kansas side, is where I ply my trade.
Perfect. So you're out actually looking at clients' properties, diagnosing and treating both cultural and insect and disease issues that you run into.
That's correct.
Awesome. So you're perfect for this discussion today.
I'm very rarely perfect for anything, Matt.
We'll call it what it is today, right, Bill? How long have you been with Ryan's?
About 13 years.
Okay. And this is not your first stint in the horticulture industry. What got you excited about horticulture?
Well, I grew up here in Prairie Village, actually. But when I was a young man, 9, 10, 11 years old, my dad leased some farmland in Leavenworth County. So I was introduced to farming. And then did much of that through my grade school, high school time. And then he also leased a ranch that I spent some time on in college. So not only the horticultural aspect, but got to do some livestock and spend time on a horse and do all kinds of different things. But it helped develop a love for the outdoors that I didn't think I could find a job inside an office anywhere that would make me as happy as working outside.
And after college, you also did some other things with horticulture, is that correct?
I worked at a place called Alex R. Masson, also known as Sunflower Sue, if you still remember those old labels of the little girl with her watering pail. I think now it's called Free State Growers. It's outside Lawrence in Linwood. It was the big greenhouse range that was destroyed in the tornado that went through the Linwood area, 4 or 5 years ago, whenever it was. And then from there, when I moved back to Kansas City, I got a job at Family Tree Nursery and was there for 24 years, 20 of them as a store manager.
Awesome. So you've got a very broad knowledge of horticulture, both from an agricultural side and from a ornamental horticulture side as well. So what I wanted to start out with was something interesting or different for our podcast, which was normally we go into a Q&A about the plants or the topic that we're going to talk about. But this actually is something that spurred a lot of interest with me. I kind of have a love for woody plants, and boxwoods fall into that. Previously, we've talked about things like turf and irrigation. So what I wanted to do was kind of geek out a little bit and talk about boxwoods before we get into the care of boxwoods and the disease and insect things. I wanted to talk about kind of some fun facts or some plant geek facts about boxwoods that I delved into last week when I was preparing this podcast. So bear with me as I share some information. The first thing that I wanted to do was really comment on how popular and how long boxwoods have been in the landscapes across the entire world. So I think some of these facts will help us get there. Number one, fossilized boxwood leaves and fruit have been found that date back 22.5 million years. So there are fossils out there that are over 22 million years of boxwoods. So definitely not anything new in the landscape. Another interesting fact. Ancient Egyptians grew formal hedges of boxwoods in their gardens as early as 4000 BC. So you think they had plant health care managers in ancient Egypt to help out with the care of their boxwoods, Bill?
I'm certain they did.
Okay.
It wasn't me, though.
Okay. So I could see them pulling around carts and treating for the issues that we're going to talk about later and trimming the hedges and all of that thing. But yes. I find it interesting that even 4,000 years back, we were maintaining boxwoods in a similar manner to how we do today. So definitely a very hardy and long-lived plant. Third thing down on my list, boxwoods were first introduced to North America in the mid-1600s. So like I said, they're a worldwide crop. They came to the United States or North America in the 1600s. Another one, boxwoods can be found in the gardens of Versailles. Did I pronounce that right, Bill? I know you're a world traveler.
Versailles. Correct.
They can be found at the home of George Washington at Mount Vernon, and they can also be found at the White House. So they're almost a staple of the American and the world, the European landscape, probably more so the European landscape than the American landscape, I would say.
I see them a lot over there.
Yes. Let's see. Parts of the boxwood plant have been used for various medicinal purposes, including the treatment of epilepsy, toothache, and the symptoms of flu. Something I didn't know at all, that they had medicinal qualities. This is kind of where we get into the modern aspects of boxwoods. According to the American Boxwood Society, there are 97 species of boxwoods and 261 valid cultivars and more coming to the marketplace every year, which I find very interesting because in my mind, most boxwoods look alike, but to think that there's 261 different individual cultivars is kind of mind-blowing to me. And then the last thing is something that's really important. Not really in our landscapes yet, but we'll kind of close out the discussion today is this talk of boxwood blight. And basically, there's a fungal disease called boxwood blight that threatens the existence of many of the boxwoods in the United States and other parts of the world. Currently, there are multiple scientific studies being conducted to find resistant cultivars, control strategies, and anything else that can slow or stop the spread of this devastating disease. So something really, really important that we have to have on the radar is that as this disease moves across the United States, all the boxwoods that are being planted that we see everywhere could potentially be wiped out. Something on the scale of emerald ash borer. That type of thing is what we need to be concerned about.
Yeah. As extensively as they are used, it would dramatically change the landscape of most of the residential neighborhoods. I know in our city and most others throughout the United States and beyond.
Yep. And something that we'll probably talk at a future episode with one of our plant healthcare managers is this discussion of planting monocultures and the issues that that can create. And that's basically what we've done with boxwoods, especially in the market that we're in. It's like I said before, the area that you take care of, I wouldn't doubt every third house has at least one boxwood.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, they're dust everywhere, and that disease could be very devastating. So I thought I'd pivot a little bit and discuss some of the care and issues that we have with boxwood. So first thing I think I'd like to chat about is why we think boxwoods are so popular. If I can drive down the street and every third house has a boxwood, if not a couple hundred of them, what do you think it is about boxwoods that draws our clients to them?
I would say that we have a landscape design mentality where we want to block our foundations of our homes with something soft, as opposed to just seeing the hard line of a home. When I was younger, it was junipers were the common choice. A row of junipers in front of a house with an upright juniper at the corner, very common. And then from that, euonymus became a little bit more popular, which is a larger leaf, semi-evergreen shrub, but could be changed into a squared or a rounded form, much like boxwoods can be. And it served the purpose for a while. And then yews became very popular. And that was through the 70s. And then suddenly it was boxwood's turn to be the plant du jour. And it serves the same function as all those others did before. But it seems to be the more modern selection. People don't want junipers because they had issues. And then euonymus had issues. And then yews began to have some issues as they grew old. And now boxwoods are overplanted. And then, as we find out from any time we overplant something, if there's a weakness, Mother Nature will certainly point it out to us. And that's what's happening now.
Yeah, I totally agree that, especially in the Midwest landscape, we are very deficient in evergreens that we can plant. There's very, very few evergreens that do well here at all. We really only have one native evergreen in the Eastern Red Cedar or Juniperus virginiana. But in this case, when we talk about the home landscape, we're very limited. And even though we have the junipers and the yews and the euonymus, I would also probably say that nothing really does what a boxwood does. Those shrubs can be sheared and shaped, but really not the tight lines and the nice even hedges. They're also forgiving a little bit too, with being able to be pruned back a little bit harder.
I would agree, where people want something a little bit more formal. And when you were doing your geeky facts, you talked about gardens like Versailles or Mount Vernon, where they have expanses of large, well-maintained aisles and paths and gardens that are very formal. And it's because of the trimming that's done on these to keep them confined to a specific place. And it is that kind of tolerance of high maintenance that makes them very appealing.
Yeah, it's I think if I were to say something, there is no other shrub that can do what a boxwood does, especially when it comes to a formal landscape. And yeah, they can be maintained in a loose nature. They can be pruned into about anything. I've seen them pruned into different animal shapes, that type of thing. But the formal square hedge, there's really nothing that does it like a boxwood does.
I'd agree.
For sure. So the second thing I wanted to talk about was, what are the cultural requirements of a boxwood? So if I'm one of Bill's clients and you're maintaining the disease and insect issues that go along with them, what kind of information do I need to grow a healthy boxwood outside of what you're doing for me as a client?
Well, that's a great question, Matt. I would say one of the appeals that perhaps we didn't bring up was the fact that they are tolerant of both a very sunny or a very shaded location, so they provide some versatility. They don't look the same as the environment that they grow in changes. They will grow a little bit thinner the more shade that it is grown in compared to a sunny location. So where people have little microclimates at their house where it's sun on one side of the front and shaded on the other, and they want boxwoods to match, it doesn't always work out that way, but they are tolerant of a variety of conditions. The requirements, as for most evergreens, is they do require moisture. And here's a good plug right now for watering. We're recording this in the middle of March, and we haven't seen substantial rainfall in quite a long time. Evergreens, any plant that's keeping its foliage through the wintertime, continues to give off moisture. And we had an incredibly warm February. It's changed a little in March here, but most landscapes are not getting regularly watered at this point, so there are still requirements through the winter months for evergreens, and boxwoods are no different. Stress increases as the drought stress on them goes up, and stress factors like that can lead to some of the issues that we'll talk about in a little while. Fertilizing, for the most part, they are tolerant of heavy shearing and respond very well with a little fertilizer to keep a nice healthy growth and a nice appearance from the landscape point of view, either the curb appeal that they provide or as you're walking around your landscape, they tend to look pretty sharp. They are fairly shallowly rooted, so it's something to keep in mind that mulching is an important part of good maintenance on boxwoods. I tend to prefer compost or a wood mulch as opposed to rocks because, as we know, stones can get hot in certain locations and that can actually stress the root system more than just even bare ground might.
Yep.
So, as far as anything else, I'm not sure.
Okay. I kind of made a list of things here too. And you addressed almost everything. I think one thing that's critical for our clients to know is that any evergreen in the landscape is not a set it and forget it thing when it comes to the dormancy period. And it's critical to keep those watered going into dormancy. And even when we have dry conditions through the winter as well, it's critical as well. Can you speak a little bit about recommendations for watering of evergreen plants during the winter? Is it an everyday thing? Do I got to turn the sprinkler system on? Is once during the winter good? Is there any rhyme or reason to that?
It will vary depending, of course, on the daytime temperatures we're getting. Nights or day length is pretty short right there. Nights are longer. So it doesn't require as much frequency as would be required during the growing season, spring, summer, fall. Maybe once every 2 to 3 weeks, dragging a hose out, which is something I find most people don't even own anymore if they have a sprinkler system. But getting a hose out, putting it at a base of a plant or a sprinkler hose that can be run through an area to soak the root system doesn't require tremendous amount of water, but enough to maintain some vigor through the dormancy period. But in fact, they probably wouldn't be dormant in February as warm as we were. So making sure that they have some water during those time, like, as I said, maybe once every 3 weeks or so, a good thorough soaking and then allowing things to dry out. It's actually detrimental to keep plants soaked for long periods of time. You can do more harm by watering too frequently as opposed to allowing them to dry out and then giving them a thorough soaking when you do the water.
Yeah, that is a critical thing, is that no matter when you're watering a plant, is plant roots need oxygen and you have to have gas exchange. And that comes not from daily watering. It'll keep all the oxygen out of the soil. And it's imperative that you water heavily and infrequently, like you said earlier, so that you have that gas exchange. You need the dry and the wet cycles to build that root system.
That's one of the little nuances of proper watering that I think most people forget. From my years in the nursery, I would actually see more plants returned dead from too much water than not enough water. And they would say, well, I was watering every day. I can't believe it died. It started looking bad, so I watered it even more. But you're actually just kind of pushing it off the ledge at that point. So the wet-dry cycle is key. A little bit of investigation. Every situation would be a little bit different as far as the soil types that they're planted in, the exposure that they get regarding amount of sun, which changes during the year, boxwoods growing in the shade of trees that are now bare. That got plenty of shade through the growing season, now sit in full sun in the wintertime. Planting on a side that gets exposed to a lot of wind changes how much water plants may need. So really, it's tough to say exactly every third Sunday, drag your hose out and soak your plants. You're just going to need to fish around a little and see what's going on and then try to amend your schedule to allow for the best results for your landscape.
Yeah, the best waterers probably are more in tune with the environment than out of tune with it. And there's really no set it and forget it kind of schedule.
No.
When it comes to plant care.
Unfortunately, that's what we're looking for, is something easy. I just want to put a reminder on my phone that I'm heading out to water on such and such a day, and it really doesn't work that way. You have to take into account if soils are frozen, if if the plants are in fact new or long established, there are all kind of different factors that will influence the frequency of the water.
Awesome. And that's something definitely you can help your clients with when you're on the property, is kind of coaching them how to water and get the right point. Cause really having a good stand of boxwoods is a partnership. Yeah. You're going to have to be out there treating for different disease and insect problems, but really the cultural issues lean on the client, and having that go between or that consultant, like a plant healthcare manager like you, can actually help get a better, healthier plant in the long run.
In my job, I generally will visit a customer's property once every 3 to 4 weeks, possibly through the months of May, June, July, August, when landscapes are probably under their greatest amount of stress and insect and disease problems will manifest themselves most quickly. And the difference of how plants look when I finish an application, say in May, and come back in June can be dramatic. And so part of it is the partnership you're talking about. They need to be observant about what's out there. And if there is an issue, then certainly I advise them to reach out to me, and I'm happy to come by and see what's going on and see what we can't do to correct any potential damage that's going on there. So,
awesome. Good insight on care. I'd like to change the direction a little bit and talk about some of the things that you're doing on a regular basis. And we're really starting to get into that season, which is the control of insects. And I'm gonna group mites in there as well. Mites are definitely a whole different issue, but boxwoods are kind of the problem child of the landscape. When I look at it, we like, as plant healthcare managers, to have plants. Kind of the foundation of any plant healthcare program is to plant something that doesn't require a lot of maintenance from a pesticide input. And boxwoods definitely don't fit that bill.
Not at all.
They need lots of care. Culturally, they're kind of forgiving. But when it comes to maintenance issues, they've got a lot of problems. So I want to kind of cover some of the problems that you're addressing, how you're addressing them, and the expectations that a client can have. The first one I'd like to kind of hit on as far as insects and mite issues goes is the boxwood mite. Can you speak to me about what you're looking for when you're looking for boxwood mites, and then some of the control strategies that you use to keep the boxwoods looking good?
Well, the boxwood mite is a cool season mite, so we tend to see most of its damage early in the season. The damage generally will appear on the leaves as stippled look, or little white pinpricks all over, very small, but they are piercing and sucking insects. So as they do their damage, and as population increases, eventually leaves can look paler and paler, almost, as I've seen in some bad infestations, white as the chlorophyll disappears, and then the plant's ability to manufacture its own food is greatly reduced because of the mite populations. Because they are a cool season mite, as opposed to, say, the two-spotted spider mite that's very common on the burning bush through the summer months around here, we look for signs of activity in the months of April, May into June. And okay, then generally they will slow down in the heat of the summer when the other mites become more of an issue in the landscape. So this is the time of year to inspect it for damage from last fall, because they can be active in the fall, and then get on a program that will help control them through the spring. They are not difficult to control, but we have found that the use of certain pesticides in an attempt to correct the problem can only aggravate the problem. Imidacloprid, which is a popular choice for control of insects in our landscapes, seems to increase the activity of mites. So when you run down to the local garden center and take the advice of some well-meaning staff member, and they sell you bare tree and shrub, for example, not to plug any one product, but and take that home and use it, you'll find that you aren't getting any control for that issue, and it perhaps will make it worse over time.
And that's important. We're probably reaching some people that are do-it-yourselfers. And one thing that's interesting about the chemistry of the pesticides that we use, whether it is a miticide or an insecticide or a fungicide, is they are very specific to the species of insect or mite that they control. And if you use the wrong product, you can actually make things a lot worse. So probably a good plug to actually hire a professional to do these treatments, to diagnose the problem, and to use the right product versus trying to do it yourself. I have witnessed several times where that people have made things a lot worse by choosing something or learning something from someone who's well-meaning but really doesn't have the education to support that, and are applying a product that basically gives them less than desirable control or actually makes things worse. So
right.
Very important.
Not uncommon to interview a client who will say, well, I just grabbed something I had in my garage. They couldn't even tell you what the product was. They're certainly unfamiliar with the label and applying it because they saw a problem, but had no real direct focus on what they were trying to control and what they were using to get that control.
Exactly. And that's the nice thing about having a professional do these treatments as well. Because yes, we are using the right product. We're using it at the right time and we're using the right amounts. And in an environmentally focused world that we live in, hiring a professional to use these things in a professional manner is actually more environmentally friendly than the running down to the Home Depot or something like that and grabbing something off the shelf and just applying it willy-nilly.
Correct. Being in this industry, I like to think that I'm very aware of the impact of the products that I use in the environment, and that I choose when I talk to my clients to have a specific approach. Certain product for a specific control, and not just I'll show up and spray everything and we'll cover it one way or another. But at this time in the evolution of our landscapes and our industry, I think knowing what you're treating, choosing a product that has the least amount of impact on the environment, treating specifically for that problem with as few applications as is possible, and in certain cases, discontinuing if it is no longer necessary.
Yeah, it's interesting that by having an educated consultant and applicator, you're actually being more environmentally friendly in the long run. Yes. Instead of just spraying everything indiscriminately, you're only applying what's needed to what product is needed to what plant needs it at the proper time.
That's correct.
Very crucial.
It's a little off the topic of boxwoods, but I found that problem with magnolias as magnolia scale became a huge insect impacting all these mature magnolia trees. We had to use several different products at different times of the year to get the control, and it was still difficult, often taking two or three seasons of applications. But as we see control, we begin to reduce the applications, the different pesticides, back to more of a maintenance level to keep the plant healthy rather than just continue to spray and apply and do whatever we think is necessary if it's not accomplishing a specific goal. So
yeah, very
a little sidebar there.
Yep. The next insect, well, first we talked about a mite. The next insect, which is separate of a mite that I'd like to speak about, is the boxwood psyllid.
Psyllids are something I think that is not really identified properly in a lot of cases. The adult causes cupping and distortion of the foliage as it feeds, and a lot of time people mistake it for the appearance of a bloom that may emerge at some point, or possibly the formation of a fruit on the plant. But as they do their damage and lay their eggs, the cupping that it causes will actually distort the growth. There are specific controls for it. Environmentally or culturally, pruning and cleaning up debris is an important part of getting boxwoods back to normal. The certain pesticides that we can apply also will give a control when they are in the adult or the nymph stage, so that we can eliminate this problem. It's not extremely widespread, certainly not as widespread as probably the next insect on your list, but it is something that I am seeing more and more of. I'm also finding it in newly planted shrubs, So I'm thinking there's probably being some sourced out of nurseries that may not be identifying the issue as well, and that that allows them to be introduced into the environment in a wider range of areas more quickly.
Yeah, and I think that's important. You brought up the subject of not every issue has to be treated with a pesticide.
No.
That some things with proper cultural controls, like humans, the more rest I get, the better I eat, all of the things that we do for our health, the more I exercise, the stronger my immune system is. And the same applies for plants as well. So I'll have less issues. So if we can concentrate on cultural issues, but there's also some things we can do too, like a well-timed pruning can actually get rid of the new growth that would have been affected by an insect like the psyllid as well.
Correct. Not just the pruning, but the cleanup afterward is just as important, because the insects that just fall to the ground will emerge from those clippings and reinfest the plant. So as far as just trying to maintain it by regular shearing, it won't happen without the other part of that, the cleanup of the debris.
That's why I had to keep the greenhouse clean all the time when I worked in the greenhouse.
That's exactly right.
Yep. Kept those things off the ground and they wouldn't reinfest the plants. The third and final insect. So as you can see, boxwoods have a lot of issues.
Yes, they do.
And we've really just started to scratch the surface. So the third and final insect that we're going to look at, or actually the second insect, the one mite, this will be the third one we're going to look at, is the one that probably causes the most damage in our landscapes in the Midwest. And this is the boxwood leaf miner. Speak to me a little bit about the damage that this causes and what kind of control measures work for this insect.
So I would say that leaf miner was first discovered in this area probably 7 or 8 years ago by a person that worked at Ryan Lawn and Tree in the PHC department. It is most widely appearing in the springtime, and it is often confused as winter burn or winter damage. And we assumed, like many people did, that that was part of it, because most of it is on the new growth. It shows up as brown growth in the springtime. Eventually, it was discovered that there was an insect that is feeding in the middle of the leaf, between the upper and lower leaf surfaces. It is likely, once again, that it was imported into the area because it had been an issue both east and west coast, and the nursery trade is one that sources material from all over the U.S. When I was at the nursery, we would buy products from Oregon, California, Oklahoma, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee. Anybody that had a good outfit with good plant material that we needed, we'd bring it in. So chances are it came to this area in shipments, and once again, probably not realizing what was there, it was introduced into the landscape. It was first discovered, I think, in the Leawood area, but then it is extensively found in especially the Mission Hills area, from there into Fairway, and now pretty much throughout the city. It's not going away.
Yeah, you'd be hard-pressed to find any city in the metro that doesn't have leaf miner.
Right. And I think customers ask me about this. They want a treatment, but they don't want to stay on a program, and they're asking if this insect will ever go away. And the truth is, because of how overplanted boxwoods are, the food source for this insect, and he's specific to boxwoods, the food source is endless. You can treat and your neighbors don't treat, so yours look great and you get off the program for a year or two and they look just like your neighbors before too much longer. And that's because the adult is a winged insect, a small gnat-looking thing, smaller than a mosquito even.
Yep.
But when they come out and fly around, they are looking for prime plant material to lay their eggs and keep their next generation going. And the better yours look, much like the better your grass looks, the more likely you are to attract grubs, the offspring of the beetles that will lay those eggs. They are looking for healthy environments to lay their eggs. And if you have good, healthy looking boxwoods, they are going to be an attractant for this pest.
So that's a description of the damage that they cause. What kind of control measures do we have for something like leaf miner? Living in between the two layers of the leaf, I assume they're more of a difficult insect to control?
They can be rather tricky. We can use systemic insecticides, and this time of year is a great time to put those out.
And what's a definition of systemic?
That would be an insecticide that we would apply to the soil. And as it is watered in, it is taken up through the root system and distributed throughout the plant. There are other systemics that can be absorbed through leaf material and translocated inside the leaf itself. But this time of year, we're focusing more on the root applications and getting a product into the plant system that, as the next generation emerges sometime in May or early June, we have a way to help provide some control without being out there to monitor it quite as much. We also have sprays that, as I mentioned, will penetrate the leaf surface and hopefully control the immature leaf miner as it's feeding inside the leaf before it pupates and emerges as that winged insect. We try to time those early in the spring before the pupation period. And then we also have a spray that's targeted towards the emergence of the adult, where we can get control before they mate and lay eggs. And that usually involves at least three sprays spaced out at probably about a 4-week interval to catch different life cycles of this pest.
Okay. Another great reason to hire a professional or partner with a professional is being able to understand these life cycles, the different insects and mites that get in there, the different control measures, the different cultural things. If we really want to grow boxwoods and they have this many problems, it's really best to partner with someone like yourself to get the best out of them.
Yes. Otherwise, you'll end up having boxwoods that are very thin, have big stretches of branches with no foliage, because as the damage increases from a leaf miner and they destroy the part of the leaf that makes it a viable leaf on the plant, eventually it'll turn completely brown and fall off. Since the leaf miner targets new growth each year, the ability of that plant to continue to thrive without new growth, the other growth on the inside is getting older and thinner and less productive, limits that plant's ability to thrive in the landscape.
Thank you. I think something that's important too, and I'd like to share this with listeners, is early on in the conversation, I shared those plant geek facts. And one of them was that there are 261 known cultivars in the industry. And the industry is coming out with new cultivars all the time. One thing that the industry is doing is trying to create new plant genetics that are resistant to these issues. And I want to hit on that because the industry is trying to find solutions that fall outside of the pesticide realm. And I think that's important, but a very difficult job to do as well. And I think the other thing that's important as well is that we say resistance. We never really see immunity to problems from genetic traits being cultivated. Sometimes we do, but most of the time it's more of a resistant type issue.
That's a great point, because I think to most people, resistance means immunity, but resistance is the less likelihood of this being an issue. It is not completely resistant to the problem. And so you can begin to introduce these plants that may require a reduced amount of applications, but probably will not eliminate them altogether.
Yeah, for sure. And along with that, as listeners go out and purchase new boxwoods, I think it's important to understand the cultivars that they're looking at and try to choose things that are resistant, if possible, because that makes your job easier. It makes the landscape look better. And it definitely reduces the amount of pesticides that are in the environment as well.
So I have seen a list of plants or boxwoods that are resistant to leaf miner. And with the couple of nurseries I visited last year, they are not commonly carried in the nurseries.
Okay.
The more common varieties, the winter gem, these kind of things that are still so in demand are the ones you generally will find. And this resistance is something that is going to be, it has to be something that's demanded by the population if we're going to see increased production of those varieties. We're going with the common name that everybody knows, but it's going to change a different, going to take a change in the thought process of the consumer to request these things before we will see them in the markets commonly.
Yeah, that's really interesting when you talk about these monocultures that are created. It's really an economics type discussion of supply and demand. We're going through the emerald ash borer issue right now. And really that was clients demanding ash trees. So everybody planted ash trees. All the nurseries supplied ash trees. Now we're losing all of our ash trees from emerald ash borer. Clients are demanding boxwoods. We're planting boxwoods in a monoculture again. We've got all these issues which we can treat for. There's some other issues we're going to talk about on the back end of this conversation that could potentially wipe out every boxwood the same way that we're having with ash trees as well that aren't treated. So it's really easier said than done. Yeah, the industry can come out with it, but until the client demands those type of cultivars, we're probably not going to see them widespread across the board.
That's my feeling on the subject, is it's going to change when we demand change.
Right. And a very critical thing for our listeners is look out and seek those type of things, because when the nursery manager hears that you're asking about some of these new cultivars that are resistant to boxwood blight or leaf miner or whatever we're talking about today, they're going to start to recognize that and bring those into the marketplace.
A little education is a dangerous thing.
It's very, very important. So we're going to move on from insects and mites. We're going to speak about disease issues. And really, there's one disease issue that we deal with boxwoods, and this would be Volatella blight. So I'd like you to speak a little bit about what Volatella blight is, if there's any control measures, and what really brings on Volatella blight in the landscape.
Volatella blight is obviously a blight of boxwoods that will usually manifest itself as a result of stress that the boxwood is under. In our landscapes, it is most frequently observed in the springtime, and the last couple of winters, we've seen quite a bit of it. It's commonly seen as a big flush of growth appears on a portion of the boxwood, and one part puts on no new growth and gradually turns brown, and it is usually one or two stems in a certain area, as opposed to the whole boxwood dies back, becomes rather unsightly, and you'll get a call as what's going on here, and we'll go out and look. The blight can cause blistering or cankering on the stems as one way to identify it. It also has a unique habit of causing the foliage to fold back flat up on the stem, as opposed to laying out a little bit more as you would see on a healthy boxwood or one that died, say, from a drought situation. So there are a couple different ways to identify it once you see it. As far as control, let's begin with culture. Since it tends to show up, in my opinion, as a result often of stress through the wintertime. We began some of this segment talking about proper watering in the winter. We've had some dry winters lately, extreme fluctuations of temperatures when plants are already stressed by other factors can lead to this blight manifesting itself in the plant. So plants that look great in November look pretty bad by April. As far as what can be done, certainly the winter watering that we talked about, winter mulching, anything that's going to help conserve the moisture around these plants will go a long way. We also can talk about the use of anti-desiccants, which is products that are sprayed in the winter months to help slow down the amount of transpiration or the loss of moisture through the foliage that plants experience. If there is no water in the roots and foliage continues to give off moisture, eventually the drought stress shows up. So by using an anti-desiccant, something that Once again, not to promote any one specific product, but people are familiar with Wiltproof as one of the things that a homeowner could use if you just have a few, or hook up a professional to apply it to larger situations where a small bottle with a trigger on it may not be a good solution. Wiltproof, something that's been around for a long time. You know, we used it on Christmas trees and greens and wreaths in the nursery, so you could take something that was evergreen and move it inside your home for a month, and it wouldn't dry out as quickly as it would, considering there's nothing there to give it moisture.
Yep, no roots.
So same thing works in the landscape. You can help seal up the foliage and perhaps slow down that rate of transpiration to keep stress from being so much. As far as a spray program, a chemical approach to controlling Volutella, the best we can talk about is perhaps suppression of the blight combined with other cultural practices. A big one that I see every time I read about this problem is overhead watering of landscapes. With our desire to use a sprinkler system, and in a lot of cases you have sprinkler heads that are hitting both the turf as well as your landscape beds, it leads to a lot of overhead watering situations. When a plant has a blister or a canker and plants stay wet from watering, it can be moved from one plant to the other pretty easily. The disease can also be spread by just the shearing of the bush itself. One plant that's affected, you use your pruners, you clean it up, you move down to the next one that was healthy is now at risk of having this blight introduced. So proper cultural practices, reducing the amount of overhead watering, those kind of things will certainly help. As far as, like I said, a spray program, there are chemicals that will list it as something that will suppress the disease. And we do use those in the landscape, but I always sort of buffer the expectations that it's part of me doing what I can and you doing what you can to keep the health of your landscape together. That's just one of these things that we don't have a good solution for. But then I would bring back up what you talked about the genetics. There are varieties that are showing resistance to this, and they are ones that are, once again, not commonly found in the nurseries in our area yet. But as these things become more of an issue, then the demand hopefully will increase their availability.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. And as you can see, boxwoods have a lot of issues. Yeah. We've talked about cultural issues. We've talked about insect and mite issues, of which we named three. We talked about a common disease issue in Volutella blight that we see. There's four or five issues there that a professional like you is dealing with on a regular basis. And all of these take a partnership between the client and the plant healthcare manager to have a good boxwood stand, to have them looking good. The last thing I'm going to kind of hit on before we close out this session is some things that are on the horizon. The first one is an invasive insect called a box tree moth. And this is an insect that is currently on the East Coast and will be working its way across the United States, depending on its rate of movement. These things are moved, like you said, through tainted nursery stock. They're brought in on RVs, cars, vehicles. They can be brought in a number of ways, but we're currently seeing this on the East Coast. Currently in the Midwest, not an issue, but it's something we need to keep our eyes out for. And then the last one that I'd like to hit on is this topic of boxwood blight, another invasive issue. And invasive is defined as something that's not native to our area. And it is an issue that really is on the level of Dutch elm disease, emerald ash borer, gypsy moth kind type of thing, where it has the potential to wipe out all of the boxwoods in a given area. Very easily spread as well.
Yeah, this is a big concern because of the sheer numbers of boxwoods we have in this area. Once it makes it here, there is no control. We're looking at digging and destroying plants. We're advised not to replant boxwoods in the area because the blight can exist in the soil. So not only will it require removal and destruction of plant material, but the need to introduce new species of plant to replace them in our landscape. So it is a potential game changer for what we see here as a common landscape in our area.
Yep. And I think it's important too. Most of the research that I talked about earlier in the fun facts of boxwoods is really pointed right to boxwood blight. It is on that level. It has major economical impacts for a company like ours, but it has an even more larger, widespreading impact on the nursery industry.
$126 million is not easily replaced.
Right. That's a big thing. We have yet to find box tree moth in a metro. We have found one instance of boxwood blight, but as with most cases of boxwood blight, it's introduced from a nursery stock situation. We were able to find that early, get it out of the landscape, get it out of the environment, destroy those plants. So I don't want people to walk away thinking that boxwood blight and box tree moth are here and going to be the end of the world, but it's something we got to keep our eyes open as professionals so that we can address these issues as they start to come up.
That's right. I think we have been mentioning the cooperative effort between me as a professional in this industry and the homeowners that I ply my trade with. In this case, it goes beyond that to where we have to have a cooperative effort between the nurseries that sell the goods and the people that purchase them for use in the home landscape. And there is, at this point, the push to have boxwoods that come in from other areas quarantined for up to 30 days before they're made available to the public. And the point of this is certain diseases can be suppressed with the application of fungicides in a growing operation before they are shipped out. Most of those applications can last up to 30 days, maybe not quite that long, depending on the frequency of watering, things like that. But if a potential problem is masked by an application of a fungicide in a growing operation before it's shipped to this area, it could possibly be detected if these plants are quarantined before they are made available to the general population. So if the nursery industry works with us, we can hopefully continue to keep this out of the area, except for maybe one or two isolated cases that optimistically are quickly identified and the proper removal of the plants and destruction of the plants takes place before it can be vectored into our environment by a pair of pruning shears or wet boots that have tracked through the area and things like that. All can begin a more of a widespread problem.
Yeah, and it's easy to see from a professional standpoint how quickly a disease like that can spread. You work in an area where a lot of the clients have their landscapes maintained. They're not trimming their shrubs themselves, which means if a boxwood blight outbreak happens on one of your properties and someone is maintaining those and they go from that property to a next, they might visit four or five properties in that day. They could potentially spread that disease to every single one of those other clients through the use of their shears. So it is a global, it's a nursery issue, it is a plant healthcare issue, it's a client issue, it's definitely the Department of Ag issue. Everybody needs to be involved. And what we found with these issues is inevitably, no matter what we do, inevitably they end up getting the best of us because not all of us are playing it 100% level. So it's something that I know is going to be a problem. It's just a matter of when and how it's going to develop. But we've seen it on the East Coast. We've seen it in other areas in Europe, and it'll probably be a big issue for us in the future as well.
I think Chicago is the closest it's been positively identified, but that's not far away when you consider the potential to bring it here. So it is something we need to stay on top of.
All right. So we're going to wrap it up. I wanted to thank you for your time today, Bill, and your expertise. And hopefully we'll have you back in the future.
My pleasure, Matt. Anytime.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ryan Lawn and Tree Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to show your support, please like, share, and subscribe. And if you're interested in having one of our turf experts take care of your lawn, please reach out to us at ryanlawn.com, and we would be happy to have one of our turf managers come out and give you a free estimate. And also, a little secret, we're offering 50% off your first application. Visit us at ryanlawn.com.